Okay, great. Let's get started. And as I said before, if you're on a speakerphone, just put it on mute, not on hold. That'll keep us from getting these microphones are so sensitive. We do keep, these are very informal calls, so we try to, if any time you have a question, we like to have that discussion. These early calls, we're starting a new cohort. We've done 16 of these over the years. We do 10 at a time. And we talk generally about environmental job training programs, how to start them, how to sustain them, what's good practices, the good do's and don'ts. And we usually have grantees who have been around for a while give a presentation about what they're doing, some of the problems they have, some of the things that work, some things that don't. We're in a particular special time now where the EPA RFP has been issued. So up until February 24th, we're going to be focusing really, rather than sustainable programs, we're going to be talking more about the RFP, which is not what we normally do, but I think it's very relevant. And usually the things we talk about are very relevant to writing a really good proposal. So we are not EPA. We've been working on this program with EPA since the beginning of the program in the early 90s. So we've been around for a while. We're very familiar with what they do. We've assisted them in helping develop the program as it goes along. But again, we don't speak for EPA, and we're not EPA policy. Now, that'll happen next week, and we'll talk about that in a second. So that gives you a general idea of what we do. We meet every 2 weeks on this phone, same time, same place. We have post-session notes, and we, of course, you get plenty of reminders before. So the next one will be in 2 weeks, same time, same place. So we usually start these off with news from Washington, and one of the things we do is like to keep people informed on what's going on. And, Glo, it's been a busy time since the last PLC.
Yeah, it sure has. Well, as you mentioned, that EPA released the new job training RFP, and it's located on grants.gov on EPA's website, and we've also got it up on our Brownfields Toolbox website. If you go to the homepage, it's brownfields-toolbox.org, and scroll down to under funding opportunities, you will see that it says FY 2016 grants. But if you click on Read More, it actually is the information for the 17 grants. For some reason, when that was updated, the information was updated, it didn't pull through.
Are you Travis's brother?
Pardon me?
I'm Buddy LJ.
Okay.
Okay. We would remind everyone that if you're on a speakerphone, could you put us on mute, please?
Anyway, for some reason, it didn't pull through to the homepage, so just ignore that and read the open. Click on Read More, and you'll see the 2017 announcement. Mike, do you want me to continue?
Yeah, continue. And whoever is on speakerphone, please mute your line because we're all hearing everything you're saying. So please mute your line. Thank you. Okay.
Okay. The next thing that they wanted me to mention, EPA is going to be hosting two outreach webinars on understanding this new RFP. Both of them are going to be held next week. The first one on January 10th, which is Tuesday next week, starting at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The second one will be on Thursday, January 12th, starting at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Both of these webinars will be the same presentation and cover the same material, but they're just being offered twice in case one time is more convenient than the other. You don't need to register for these webinars, and I will put out a listserv announcement to that link to the page where the webinar starts. And Mike, you might want to put that in the post-session notes too, the link to that.
Okay, good.
And then the last thing that they wanted me to mention is that the call for ideas is now open for the EPA 2017 National Brownfields Conference, which is going to be held in Pittsburgh, December 5 through 7. So if you go to the brownfields2017.org website, you'll see a link for Call for Ideas. And they do encourage everyone to send their ideas for sessions. And then it takes, what, maybe a month, I think, Mike, to
right.
be notified whether or not your session's been approved.
Great.
And that's it from me.
Good. There are, this year, there's two major meetings. One, of course, all PLC members can attend our annual all-grantee meeting. It'll be in Alexandria. That'll be on starting on the 8th, and you'll get plenty of notices about that. And that's, it's basically free. You have to get there, but after you get there, just one or two meals that you have to pay for, and the rest is a kind of a two-day, very intensive session and communication exchange on all types of information regarding these environmental workforce development job training programs. The other one is the one in December that Glo mentioned is in Pittsburgh, and that's everybody. Everybody that has anything to do with Brownfields, Superfund, insurance companies, employers, remediators, job training people, activists. And that's really very important to go to because it's a great way to network and get in touch with people. And we've got announcements on all these things will be in the post-session notes, so you can read them. And in fact, even if you wanted to have a booth there, we are going to have a booth, HMTRI, and we're welcoming anyone to bring their materials to our booth. But if for some reason you may want to have your own, you can sign up. They're kind of expensive. Glo, what are they for a nonprofit?
For nonprofit, it's $9.75.
Okay,
they
it's a little
price. $500 deposit.
Yeah. And there's about 4,000 people that attend. We do this; these national brownfields conferences are attended, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people, and they're every 18 months. So it's a big deal. Our grantee meeting is about 150 people, and it's basically very small groups, and we break into everything about environmental job training, pretty much like these PLC calls, but face to face. So let's get started on what we want to do. This is the first session of the next 10 calls. And as I said, up until the 24th, when these workforce development job training proposals are due, we're going to be focusing on items that really relate to the grant. After that, we'll be talking to some of our most successful grantee programs to get an idea of what they did. But let's now focus on what we need to do. And what I want to do today is kind of prepare everybody for the two webinars. We talk informally about developing really good job training programs, which is what EPA is looking for, putting people to work and how to respond basically to the same criteria that they ask you for. But we're not policy people and we're not EPA. On next Tuesday and Thursday, you're going to be confronted or talked to in these webinars for about an hour, and it'll be all about the RFP and specifically what they're looking for. But it's real easy to go through these webinars and they all glance over and not a lot of questions, and then later you end up with some questions that you wish you would have asked. So I want to talk a little bit about maybe the sticky points in this RFP that may cause you some issues. Then I also want to talk today, because it is out now, and it's due in just under 2 months. I want to talk a little bit and repeat what you really should be doing now, because these things take a lot of time, some of the things. It's one thing to write the proposal, which is really the last step, but to gather certain information and establish certain relationships takes a long time, and some of these things we're even pushing the limit at this point. So let's talk first about the RFP when it came out. And it's really well written. In fact, Rachel, not only they spent a lot of time on the RFP, and it took some extra time from November till now to make sure it was the way they wanted it. And she did an excellent job and expanded it slightly from last year. It doesn't change very much from last year. We suggested all the participants use last year's, and that was a good suggestion because it barely changed. But what did change in the RFP, things were better explained, more detail. And it's really pretty much a do-it-yourself read if you go through it. There are some questions that are sticky that we'll talk about, but pretty good, pretty well, very thorough. And in addition, she added the frequently asked questions, which further explains some of the things in that RFP. So it really really was a well-written RFP, but not easy, not easy at all. So let's talk about one of the most important parts is you really need to kind of, when you from now till the 24th of February, you need to think about, let's get our team together. And what do we need to do? And you kind of have an administrative team that's going to have to work on the just the submission process. And then you're going to have your technical team who is going to start gathering data. And I would start gathering data and then start writing a little later. Make sure you get all your basic information down. But on your administrative team, and they spell out very closely. Now, those of you who have submitted government grants recently are in pretty good shape, and particularly the re-up people that have had grants. You can't submit if you submitted last year, but before that, we have many grantees. About half the grantees turn out to be grantees that have been funded before and about half new ones, 16 or 17, so 8 or 9 of each. That's not a hard rule of thumb, but in looking at the last couple awards, that's kind of how it broke down. The number of grantees, you're probably talking about maybe 4 times that 17, so maybe 50 or 60. If we look at what happened before, so you might have a 1 in 4 chance. The thing about these grants is there's a very tight range between some of the best and those who are chosen and those are not. And the last round, we had several grantees who just missed it by a hair, just a point or two. And that ranges from, 98 down to about 91 and when in these evaluation criteria. So it's a very narrow field. So it's really important to answer not only every question, but every question very thoroughly and demonstrating how you're not doing just boilerplate or getting stuff off the internet and plunking it down. So in these general terms, you really have to think of what you can do that is going to make you better than 3 other people to get this grant. And that's really important. So when we talk about the administrative side of it, it's very well spelled out what you have to do. And this is all about registering with grants.gov. The only way to submit, except if you have a very special exception, is to go through grants.gov. Well, going through grants.gov is not trivial, because you have to register, and you have to, of course, make sure you have a DUNS number. Once you get a DUNS number, you've got an e-business coordinator, and this will be the person that's going to first make contact with grants.gov, and they're going to be using the grants.gov information, and they're going to go through SAMS, that's the System for Administrative Management. They want to get you set up so that once you get approved, you're pretty well organized. They know who to contact. They have all the contact information from the local organization. And once that eBiz point of contract gets established with grants.gov, and they go through the SAMS, the training for the System for Administrative Management, then they can choose the authorized person, the person authorized to submit the grant, the AOR. These are all government acronyms that they have, but it's well spelled out. And that's the person that has to submit this grant. And so what I'm saying in several words is you've got to make sure that your organization has got that all in place. And the time to do it is now, because some of these things take a little bit of time. You've got to make sure you've got a DUNS number, you're registered. Even if you've submitted, and this has to be done every year, so even if you submitted 2 or 3 years ago and you haven't had an active grant, you really need now to find out who in your organization is the point of contact, and that you're designated, or whoever is going to submit the grant is designated as the authorized person to do that. That could be done separate of what you as a technical project officer may need to do, but you need to get that in the works because it may take 2-3 weeks to get all that accomplished. And of course, we don't have a whole lot of time. So get that going and then we can get started on actually doing what we want to do is write this grant. So let's look at some of the things that are going to take some time. And of course, in the information that you're sent, and you probably have it already, we'll make sure that everyone's got the frequently asked questions and the RFP. You noticed in there that you've got the threshold criteria and then you've got the evaluation criteria. Threshold is pretty straightforward. It's just qualifying you to submit this grant. And again, you want to make sure you meet all those criteria. You're going to do all the work. You want to make sure your grant submission and all the paperwork I just talked about is done, but you're going to want to make sure that your threshold criteria are met. And they're pretty straightforward and logical, being a nonprofit, doing HAZWOP or training, the 1910-120, pretty well spelled out. And you should be able to go check mark each one of those. And of course, as you go through this grant, I would check mark everything and assign a person to make sure all this is verified and done, and then report back on a weekly, semi-weekly basis that it's been done or not to check off each of these. So once you've gotten past your threshold and you've done your DUNS work, now you could start looking at some of the fun stuff about this program, how you're going to organize it, what you're going to be teaching, how you're going to be deciding what to teach. And as you go through this grant, one thing you're going to notice is they're going to be asking for some very detailed information on what you're going to be training, how much it's going to cost, who's going to be doing it, the background of their experience. And here's one of those items that's going to take some time to do, because you might say, I'm going to hire a trainer, or I'm going to use a community college. Well, who? And then you say, well, I can't, it's a chicken and egg thing. I want to get the grant and then I want to get the contractor. Well, no, that's not the way you need to do it on this particular grant. You really want to lock in your trainer before you even start, because you could, and how do you do that is the question. Well, you submit, and you have to, if you're going to use a contractor or a consultant, and not a subgrantee, which we've talked about before, the difference in that, you have to go through the EPA procurement process, which is meaning basically the three bids, qualifying someone that meets all the standards of EPA procurement. And that's basically, it's not as hard as it might seem initially. You could go out on the internet, or you might go to perhaps it'll be a community college if you're going to have a specific amount for training. You're going to go to a consultant, maybe a company, and you're going to set up an RFP that says this is the type of training you want to do. You need cost for the training, what they're going to charge you. And you're going to have to put some stipulations in there. One is this acceptance is dependent on you getting the grant, that they meet all the procurement requirements, and then you get the three bids. You don't have to accept the lowest one. You may get two or three people who will be doing your training for you, but you want to do that now. Start now, because some organizations have more stringent requirements, and you may have to follow their requirements, particularly if you're in a community or a larger city. You may have to go through City Hall for some way, and they may have more stringent requirements. So start right now and start saying, who are we going to do the training? How are we going to get them on board? And they can't write your grant for you. And if they were to give you information without being on board, they may not be the ones you're going to use. So if you wait till after the grant has already been awarded, you're going to be kind of behind the eight ball. And the question is, how do you get the numbers correct for doing the training? So my advice would be to get them on board now in these initial stages, charge someone in your organization with doing that, and get them on board, do the competitive bidding, document what you're doing, whether it's on email or you're calling or just getting the bids, And then once you get them on your team, it's going to be contingent on you getting the award, but have them give you costs of training, perhaps training schedules, who's going to be the training, getting their credentials so that you can put them in the grant. So you'll be able to use their experience as part of your grant. Now, and you'll be able to fill out all the tables fairly easy. Now, the next question I have to ask myself is, well, what are you going to be training? You just told me you're going to bring on trainers, but now how am I going to tell them what courses I want? Well, this is why you have to start early. You have to get your labor market assessment going. You have to get your advisory board going real early. So we've talked about that. And so the labor market assessment, I don't know what that is, but maybe put us on mute. There we go. So you want to get your labor market assessment right away. And how do you do that? You combine that with your gathering your advisory board. You start contacting potential employers. And in previous PLCs, we've talked about this in detail, about how you do a face-to-face labor market assessment. You work backwards. You find the people who are most likely to hire your students when they graduate. You ask them what kind of courses they want. And then you ask them if they can refer you to other people, other employers or potential employers, and try to get you keep working on them and seeing, can you give me a verbal commitment that you would look at our graduates? And if they say, well, we're not hiring, or not, we would like you to train to this, but we're not going to hire your students. Well, you may want to listen to them, but not necessarily stop there. You want to help them as part of your labor market assessment, that they are willing to look at your employers. They really have a demand for X number of people over the next 2 years or 3 years. And that you can also put into your grant. And you may be able, if you're fortunate enough, get some employers who want to serve on your advisory board. They're going to give you guidance on the types of courses you're going to train. And you can then go to your consultant, your training person, and say, we have decided from our labor market assessment that these are the courses we want to do. So you put that on your RFP. You're going to have you're going to have absolutely HAZWOPR. You may have RRP and asbestos removal and lead and asbestos. You may have some OSHA 10 construction. You may be using various trainers, but you'll be able to kind of doing this work backwards at the same time to not only get your advisory board together, get your labor market assessment done, and also answer the questions on the training courses. So that's why you really need to start now and not wait too long. It would be impossible to do this if you just started, okay, we got to write this grant. Fortunately, we got enough time to do all these things. The next question is, and this may be something that some of you may want to make sure you clarify with EPA, is when it's on page 2 of the RFP, they've done a very good job of spelling out the types, use of grant funds, and what they could be spent for. And as you look further down on the RFP, you're going to find out that EPA is getting funds from various offices, program offices within the agency. Traditionally, this program was started with Office of Brownfields, and they have contributed the lion's share, almost $3 million to this program, $2.86 million. As time has gone on, other program offices have come to them and say, well, we'd like you to include our program in jobs in solid waste or Superfund cleanup or wastewater, emergency preparedness, enhanced environmental health and safety, integrated pest management, and alternative emerging technologies. These are offices that EPA went to them, and they know this is the only real training program for jobs in EPA. There's one other that's quite different that's not to this extent. But these programs wanted to jump on board, but they didn't. They're not contributing large amounts of money. As you go through the RFP, you're going to see they range from $10,000 that they're willing to put in solid waste up to, I think, water is the highest at $40,000. So the dilemma that EPA had, the project officers and OBLR, the organization that's operating this program, said, we're contributing almost $3 million and these other people are contributing less. We really can't let, from an optics point of view, grantees come in and use brownfields money to train people going into pest management or wastewater. So we have to put something in this RFP that kind of puts this in the line so that we're training. We want to train these other organizations who are contributing to this program, but we don't want to use OBLR funding, the brownfields training funding, to support their program. So it's one of these smokestack type things. So what they've done on this program, the extra money they put in, it allows us to have more grantees, but at the same time, they have to put some kind of guidance in. And so when you look to page 2 on the RFP, you're going to see that they want you to train in the brownfields hazardous waste training primarily. But then you can also do some other training, even to the extent of doing advanced training in some of these 7 other areas. You just have to be careful. Most courses that you think of will fit under the brownfields hazardous waste training. Things like RRMP and lead, asbestos, OSHA 10, those would fall into the general category of brownfields hazardous waste training. But if you want to train in integrated pest management and you want to, and that's good, you can give an awareness, a certificate in that, but be aware that they only have about 10,000. They're trying to allocate this that on the 17 grantees, they can really only fund about $10,000 worth of training for all of them. So you might have a $500 program in integrated pest management to give a certificate, but it's you want to use it as awareness, but not necessarily as your prime training. So you've got to be a little careful here. And here's where it gets a little sticky. You may want to start asking your regional coordinator or even on these calls on Tuesday and Thursday of next week. If you have specific questions about a course, you may want to talk to Rachel when she'll be on the line. Now, she's talking policy. That's EPA. If you have a course that's in question, you may want to ask those questions. Does this course, would this be funded? Is this an allowable funding? And they would be the one to make the decision about that. We've recently had a question about OSHA 10, which is it's a construction course, and does that fit in any of these categories? And that's the question. And Rachel said, the fact is that there's, when you look at that course, there's fit up and health and safety and working with respirators. And when you're working on a brownfield site, you're going to be wearing these respirators and you may be doing some deconstruction. So it is an allowable course because you've got health and safety as part of your remediation. Now, the difference between that is, can I teach a carpentry course? No, not with this money, because carpentry has nothing to do with environmental remediation. So a good rule of thumb on all these questions, we had a question today about a readiness course. And the question is can I get a readiness employment readiness course certificate? And again, a good question to ask, does this have to do specifically with environmental remediation or one that fits in one of these categories? And it's pretty much clear that no, that would not be allowable course. Now, it doesn't mean you can't teach it. In fact, you'd want to provide that guidance, but it has to be done with leverage funding. So you want to get some funding either from the WIB, Workforce Investment Board, or from another organization that's willing to leverage and put on that type of training and certificate. And there's lots of people, and this is another thing you have to start early on. You have to line up who's going to do all that training that you can't do under this program. And unfortunately, again, as a guidance, if it has to do with environmental remediation and health and safety associated with that remediation, yes, that will be funded under this grant. If it has to do with anything else, no, it won't be funded under the grant. It needs to be leveraged. So that takes some time, and it's something that you really want to get started on at this point. There are some other things that, like community input and, as I said, your leveraging partners that you're going to want to start talking to, whether they're a workforce investment board, community college, or employers. And in other PLCs, we've talked about these, and we will in future PLCs, we'll be talking about that. So these are the questions you want to do. And another thing I want to suggest very strongly is read the RFP and read the frequently asked questions and write down some questions. She'll go, Rachel and some of the other people at EPA will go through slide by slide on all of these requirements that is in this RFP. But I would try to, as you read about what you're going to have to be doing, I would start asking the sticky questions, because everyone will be interested in that. Is this particular course allowable? How do I determine whether or not this is one of those courses that may be restricted, for example, in pest management or enhanced health and safety? Generally, people put those seven non-brownfields courses and areas of training in more like awareness courses, where they're maybe providing certificates in that area, and they're doing awareness because they want their graduates to be able to get jobs in some of these other fields. Pest management is a great one for applicators. Wastewater treatment has got a lot of people retiring in that field. So if they have the basic brownfields training and they have a little bit of awareness training in wastewater systems, they have a great opportunity to get a job, not in your main area that you're training, but in some of these other areas. So I think that's, again, something you really, really want to look out. So all of these things, when you read through these that you just read in the last week, it could be very overwhelming. But again, our grantees who seem to do well will take this thing apart, make a whole bunch of copies, and they'll start assigning tasks to different people and put one person on gathering labor market data, get someone to work with them on getting their advisory boards together, get someone else on some of the courses and who may be your trainers. You definitely want to get someone on your leveraging partners and assign every task. And then, of course, we're going to get into this later on how you actually go about responding to some of these questions. So this today, and we're out of time, we like to keep these to 30 minutes. We're talking in general about these things that you need to start right now. Next time on the 11th, we'll start answering some of these questions that we've gotten over the years on some of these topics. And then on the 18th, we'll start getting into the narrative and some ideas that people have had in terms of responding to the specific narratives. So does anyone have any questions at this point of in general, in terms of what they see going forward in the next 2 months? Any?
Mike, can you talk a little bit about the size of the programs, whether EPA prefers large groups of graduates, small groups of graduates, urban versus rural type thing? I've had a couple questions on that, so maybe just a quick summary on that would be helpful.
Sure. We've had programs for as few as 8 up to, maybe 80 or 90. And some of the arts program out in Oakland, he has combined it to go in tandem with a youth build program. So he takes the best people coming out of youth build and then sends them into the environmental training program. And he tends to have large programs. He may have 50 or 60. I would say the average size is 20 to 25. We're looking for placement percentages above 73%. They say that they have averaged over the life of the program about 73% placement. There have been talk about upping it. They want you to have a minimum of placement. We have programs that place 100%. And the more personal your program is, the more successful you're going to be in placing students. As far as rural and urban, of course, the easiest programs are the urban programs, because you've got there, and we'll talk about it later, is the recruitment process is extremely important. And you may have 200 or 300 people wanting to apply for this program. You've got to bring it down to 25. I think the hardest programs, but the ones that EPA really likes and focuses on, are the rural. They're very difficult because you don't have as many to choose from. You don't have as many employers in the area. You have more challenges with getting students to the program. When we talk about Alaska, they actually bring students to Fairbanks and they put them up for training, and then they go back home and come back, or they go to different training locations. So rural is very important to this program. Tribal is very important to this program. I would say when you talk about special conditions, being rural is at the top of the list. It's very difficult, but very important. And anyone who has a rural program, I wouldn't hesitate to apply. I think while you have more challenges, we have programs that have worked around it, and they've been very successful. We've had some that have had problems in terms of recruiting and having a large disparity of education. But definitely, if you are a rural program, I would apply, because maybe in some respects they want to have a distribution. You may have even a better chance of getting something under this special circumstance than someone. There might be multiple programs in an urban area. So definitely apply. Definitely look for employers around the area. They may even be national employers, but yeah, definitely do that. Anyone else? Any questions?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mike, this is Ann from Santa Fe Community College, and we're looking to fill jobs at Los Alamos National Lab in their cleanup efforts.
Right.
And one of the prerequisites for working at a national lab is having a security clearance. And so some of the disconnected youth and at-risk folks that we may want to train would not be eligible for those jobs. And the question I have for you is, you know, can we have a prerequisite that you have to be able to have a clean record and so forth?
We've had this with other grantees. And it's an interesting question, because the first thing that pops to mind is this a government jobs program and you have to accept everyone? You do have to look at everyone, but you have to be able to bring in people who you can place. It's very analogous to drug screening. Drugs may be illegal in Oakland, but you can't get a job if you're on drugs. So they can impose something in their program that says you're going to be drug tested, and if you can't pass a drug test, we can't accept you into the program. So there's a difference between you have to look at everyone. It's a fair thing to do, but you're bringing maybe 50 people down to 25 people, and you may have some fallouts. So you're going to have to say one of your criteria may be, I would say, in your recruitment process, you will look at everyone. But if you're going to get a job at the national lab, you're going to have to be able to pass a security clearance. And it could even be a criteria for acceptance. Now, having said that, you may find some other employers that are ancillary to Los Alamos. For example, what if Los Alamos has a hiring freeze? This has happened to another grantee where they were promised all kinds of jobs, and then the funding for those jobs was delayed for a year. They really found themselves in a panic. So you may want to concentrate on Los Alamos, but and have them on your advisory board, but have a plan B. And then, then that plan B, that's where you look at everyone, may come in handy. I would be very scary about just saying that all your graduates are going to go there, because one of the evaluators is going to come up with the same thing I just did that says, what happens if you have a hiring freeze, you know, or that would wipe out your program.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I'm sure as we go along, we'll have other questions. as I said, the next week we're going to start getting more into the nitty-gritty. This first of these PLC calls, I wanted to just kind of lay the groundwork of what we're going to be doing, and then we'll get in. Now, between now and the next time, you'll get some post-session notes, and if you have any questions, you'll get those on Friday. If you have any questions you want to ask, just write back with those questions. And you can also, if you're not signed up for the post-session notes, just send me an email, msenyu@aol.com or GLOW, and you've probably gotten a notice from one of us that you want to be on the list or you want to be taken off the list, okay? Anything else today?
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Kathleen.
Angela at Pathstone. I'm not going to make the call next week, and I just wanted to make one comment before we hang up, which is, if anybody's thinking about doing this program in a rural area, please don't think it supports itself.
Good.
You're going to have some kind of ancillary funding to run this program in a rural area. It cannot be a standalone, unless you're serving like four people.
Right. Well, you've got a very good point, and we've in previous PLCs talked about. I really like programs that attach onto others. I kind of talk about it as like a moving train, and if you add one more car to a train that's going, it's a no-brainer. But if you have to make the whole train, it's tough. And so you joining a youth build program, or we have Goodwill. If you join a Goodwill program, a lot of this is already going. You've got your financial people on board. They may have already, they've got the DUNS number. They may already have submitted a grant and have the ability, the eBiz contact, and they can just authorize you to submit. So they may have their own grant writers. So absolutely, if you're in a rural area, I would say if you're in any area, my first choice, if I were doing it, would be to find an organization that you could work with. And they may even be the ones to submit, and you work with them if you're too small, and attach on or partner with them for resources or leverage with them. Absolutely. That's a very good point. It's almost impossible to do this by itself, mostly because of the non-remediation courses that you could only fund those with leverage funds. Well, we're sorry we're going to miss you next week.
Well, I'll listen to the recording.
We'll send you post-session notes.
Thanks.
Okay. Anything else?
Yes. Can I get the information to be put on the list, please?
Like, sure.
Whatever email.
Sure. Give me, let me, do you have a pencil there?
Yes, I do.
Okay. msenew@aol.com. Just put your contact information. That's M Senew. That's S with a like Sam. msenew@aol.com. And that will just send me your contact information. And you'll get post session notes and reminders.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. We've had a couple people who have, and I've got to write back to them, that have Facebooked me, and we really work with email. We're kind of old-fashioned. So if you have sent a Facebook, I would just, again, go back to that the old way and send us an email with your contact information. It'd be helpful. Okay. Well, good luck, everyone. Once you get into it, it starts out taunting, but once you get into it and get everyone assigned a program, it's pretty neat. Works well. Okay, well, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.